Welcome to Monday Afternoon. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You just heard Austin Jenkins and Olympia telling you about how they're fine-tuning and talking about expanding the rules on marijuana. Well, here is yet another example. Pot cafes. Does that make you think Amsterdam? Perhaps. You've seen a Rick Steves documentary or two? Well, they're talking about pot cafes here in Washington State. It's a proposal being discussed in Olympia by lawmakers. You know, now it's illegal to consume pot in public in Washington, but there's a new bill to let Seattle and other cities opt out of the ban. Supporting that effort to legalize pot cafes is Seattle's city attorney, Pete Holmes.
The idea is to offer a place where people can consume marijuana out of public view, which is prohibited still under 502. There are many people who would like to consume cannabis who do not have the luxury of a private home, or tourists, for instance, visiting Seattle and the like. There's any number of folks who would need an opportunity to consume it legally if we're going to insist that you not consume on the streets.
So these are not cafes with outdoor tables and people are smoking pot, you know, along the sidewalk.
Well, the first requirement would have to be that they be out of public view. That's, again, a requirement that's entrenched in 502. But at the same time, where the problems have really arisen under the Clean Air Act, you're permitted to have a smoke-free environment as an employee or as a passerby. We know that there's harmful effects of secondhand smoke, whether it's tobacco or cannabis. Consequently, in Seattle, as we started to drill down and look at this, it was the Clean Air Act that presented the biggest impediment. And we realized in discussions with the Downtown Hotel Association that has been interested in marijuana tourism, for instance, you have a automatic exemption from the Clean Air Act. 25% of hotel rooms can be designated as smoking rooms. So they already had this opportunity to do this. And operationally, one of the things they could do is perhaps insist that these be electronic smoking devices or edibles, not actual combustion.
So you don't want pot smoking in pot cafes. You want to allow vaping and edible pot.
Vaping would be the logical way because there's been no scientific evidence yet that shows a secondhand impact from the use of vaporizing.
Why are you devoting so much of your energy to there being more pot use?
I'm trying to facilitate adult use. And government can lose its way with the best of intentions. It can see obvious problems that we can all agree on. Youth access to marijuana, impaired usage on the highways or in the workplace. Those are all problems that are legitimate areas of concern for government to address. But we tend to come at these things often with a chainsaw to cut butter. We're overbroad and we then impinge on individual liberties. Working out those details, though, when you've had decades and decades of simple prohibition, mindless knee-jerk prohibition, means that you have to really construct these systems from the ground up, and that takes time.
This would be up to each city and county, whether they want to have pot cafes,
right?
Mm-hmm. Opt in or out. I smell pot on Seattle streets, particularly U District, downtown. Why isn't the city enforcing the outdoor smoking ban more?
The city is enforcing the outdoor smoking ban. You know, we had an initial stumble, I think, at launch. It was pretty famous last year. There were a number of pot tickets issued in one area of the city and 80% or more by one single officer. Since those tickets, at Chief O'Toole's request, with she and I working closely together about what is the policy, I'm happy to report that as of last year, more than 500 tickets have been issued in the city of Seattle.
Well, of course, nothing is enforced completely and perfectly. How big a problem do you think it even is that some streets smell skunky when you walk by?
It's subjective, and part of this is a normalization process. During Prohibition, of course, a beer garden would be unthinkable, at least out in public. And I think that we will find this new liberty, this new change in government policy is going to be handled more responsibly. But I have to be concerned. I'm not personally offended by what I see on the streets. In fact, go to New York, go to Denver. It's amazing the open usage that I see in those places. I have to worry, though, about that family in the summer at Seattle Center, for instance, where you've got a bonehead that insists on smoking a joint right next to them. That's not fair. That's a legitimate secondhand impact. That's an area where 502 has been laying the groundwork to try and change some of this behavior. And just remember, if you're going to exercise a liberty, don't do so in a manner that impinges on others around you.
What about the social justice of who gets nailed for using pot, right? Early on, it was enforced heavily on homeless people, on African Americans. How are we doing on being fair about who can use?
We did stumble out of the gate. It was very clear. And I think with more broad geographic enforcement, you're going to see more equal demographic enforcement as well. But there is absolutely no question that we found that our drug laws in particular are enforced in a disparate manner. That is a harm that we need to stay focused on. It's one of the reasons behind marijuana cafes. It's one of the reasons that we're going to continue to always watch what kind of results are we getting on the ground.
You've talked about marijuana tourism. How much do you want to get the reputation for being the Amsterdam of America?
I think that we're trying to avoid having that moniker. I think that there's a lot of negatives associated with the Amsterdam cafes. For one, remember the Amsterdam model, the back door of those cafes, the delivery of marijuana remains illegal. It's the sale that they simply sanction and tolerate at the front end in small increments. We're not proposing allowing sale on site in these marijuana cafes. It's one of those things where you'd have to basically BYOB, bring your own bud. Those two instances alone are a big departure from Amsterdam. Again, it's the rule of law. We're trying to make sure that we're not engaged in the hypocrisy that really is behind Amsterdam, where it's still illegal to deliver and we're just going to look the other way when tourists come in and buy marijuana. We want a legally sanctioned framework.
Pete Holmes, Seattle City Attorney, telling you about a new bill that would let Seattle and other cities decide whether they want to allow pot cafes. It's one of a number of things he's in support of as we keep fine-tuning our marijuana laws. Pete Holmes supports a proposal in Olympia to allow legal marijuana delivery services. We'll keep following the issue here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Coming up here on the program, Macklemore has a new song. Perhaps you've heard it. A 9-minute anthem about white privilege.
It's not an easy 9 minutes.
Even for me, I'm like, oh man, go easy on yourself a little bit.
That's Seattle musician Aha Maluo. He was part of the project, and we're going to talk with him in about 40 minutes here on KUOW Seattle. KUOW's The Record. 12:15 is the time. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. The Seattle boom means a lot of new construction, new apartments, condos, new commercial spaces going up every place. All of that construction might be a minor inconvenience for you, or it might be a huge problem if you have a disability. KUOW's Andy Hurst reports.
Mark Adrian has lived in Seattle for 25 years. He's co-chair of the city's Commission for People with Disabilities, and he's also blind. He gets around with the help of a guide dog.
The name of the dog is Trek, as in Star Trek. Trek and I have been working together since September 1st. He is a yellow lab American, and he's an awesome dog.
Adrian says navigating construction sites can be challenging, especially when you're unfamiliar with the area. To show me, we went up to Capitol Hill. His destination is a small grocery store on the corner of Pike and Bellevue. He starts his route about 3 blocks away.
Trucker, halt. Trek forward. Let's go. Find a curb. Hop up.
Good boy. Little treat. Let's get you a bigger treat.
There you go, pup. Okay, Trek forward and go right. Trek right. Right.
He navigates one construction site relatively easily, but then he hits an obstacle. Two large signs that say construction ahead have been placed in the middle of the sidewalk. They're meant to alert pedestrians to a construction site behind us.
What was going through my mind now is that I ran into a sign which to me now says there's construction ahead of me, not behind me. So the logic isn't working for me on this one at all.
He continues down Bellevue Avenue. Construction crews are putting up a 7-story mixed-use building where Bauhaus Coffee used to be.
Okay, so the dog is telling me we can't go forward. Length fence, but... Okay, Trek, hold on. I'm going to get my cane out. Okay, buddy, hold on.
The sidewalk is completely blocked. Adrian taps around to figure out what to do.
The scaffolding sticking out here in the sidewalk is giving me mixed messages, like perhaps there's a pathway through the scaffolding. And the signage or the gate or whatever that's blocking it is halfway past the scaffolding. So, anyways, we're crossing the street.
He crosses the street and then crosses back again. 2 construction sites and a couple of misplaced signs later, he finally makes it to the corner store.
The goal is to make it easier for people with mobility challenges or site challenges to navigate around construction sites. It allows people to stay on the same side of the street, so it makes it easier for them to get from point A to point B.
That's Brian DePlace. He directs the Street Use Division at Seattle's Department of Transportation. He says the city has taken steps to make Seattle more accessible for people with mobility challenges. A new rule requires developers to only close sidewalks as a last resort. If sidewalks do have to be closed, the curb lane is then converted into a walkway. Instead of orange cones, the new standards require a durable barrier between the street and the sidewalk.
So what this allows is for if someone has a cane, they can detect the outer edge of the sidewalk and know how to navigate around the construction zone safely and predictably.
DePlace says the city is planning to do even more to help people with disabilities get around town. He says the passage of Move Seattle, the $930 million transportation levy, will make a big difference.
There's a lot of projects in there that prioritize safe sidewalks, curb ramps, safe routes to schools. So really, there's a huge priority on pedestrian access in the levy, and we'll be marching through this year implementing a lot of those projects.
Back on Capitol Hill, Mark Adrian says the city can help in other ways. He says a big solution could be an app or website with up-to-date information on which sidewalks are closed.
You can put in where you're going, where you're starting from, and it could literally say, you're going to want to walk around this. You know what I mean? I can reroute myself if I knew the information,
Adrian says barriers and challenges caused by construction projects may slow him down, but they aren't going to stop it.
If I need to get there, I'm going to get there.
Andy Hurst, KUOW News.
So right there, you just heard Mark Adrian tell you about a potential solution. More information, an online map that shows what's accessible to people with disabilities and what's not. Well, that exists. It's called Access Map Seattle, and it's being developed right now by students and faculty at the University of Washington. The project grew out of a hackathon that was put on by Seattle's Department of Transportation. Leading the effort is Anat Caspi. She directs the UW's Tasker Center for Accessible Technology. She told me that one of the key features of the Access Map has to do with elevation.
If I am having issues walking a quarter of a mile or more, I want to know what kind of grade am I going to scale when I go up this particular street.
Right. That's not in Google Maps, but it's huge if getting up and down steeply is a big issue for you.
Absolutely.
So elevation changes, curb ramps.
Curb ramps is another feature. We used SDOT information about all of the sidewalks in that are property of the city of Seattle. And we annotate where the curb ramps are so people can plan their route and figure out where they might be able to cross the street if they require a curb ramp. Other information are publicly available elevators, for example, to traverse from 4th Street to 3rd in downtown Seattle. You might want to use the Benaroya Hall elevators. But these are not actually publicly available data. The students went out and met with
power users. That takes some creativity.
Yeah. They met with power users that were able to, off the top of their head, just list off all of those publicly accessible elevators, ramps, things of that nature that they use on a daily basis in downtown Seattle.
Yeah, it's striking me how it's not just data, it's people who actually know how to get around giving you tips. This is open
both.
Then, but
it's
not
both.
That.
Right?
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a large component of crowdsourced data, absolutely. And even with respect to the permits, which I haven't gotten to yet, but we also process on a weekly basis construction permit information from the city of Seattle. And those also have to be modified in order to make corrections, because oftentimes the permitting information does not actually reflect the true sidewalk closures that exist in the city.
What do you want this map to have that it doesn't?
The key right now is to allow for routing. All of the routing algorithms that we see on a daily basis in Google Maps, when you type in two addresses, I begin here, I end here, they're always optimizing for shortest distance or potentially shortest time. The types of costs that our population incurs are different, right? The power mobility users that I described, they cannot possibly negotiate a sidewalk without a curb ramp. And so those are all no-goes. It doesn't matter if it's a short path. So we're looking at customizing routing as our sort of biggest priority right now.
Anant, what is your personal stake in making Seattle more accessible?
Well, this idea began when I moved to Seattle with my 4-year-old child who is in a chair. And we were trying to go to new places. And finding new places is something that I think any person that's living in a community should be able to negotiate and identify routes, be able to participate in the community. And so I was trying to find a house, trying to figure out what neighborhoods are better for us to use, and be able to go for walks and find parks. All of these types of things are highly dependent on the types of sidewalks and pedestrian spaces that are available. And this kind of information was really lacking over maps. So basically what it meant is that if I wanted to go anywhere with my daughter, I had to survey the place beforehand. It also means that we are now able to plan much better the kinds of trips that we make out into the community. And to me, that's a huge boon.
You've been listening to Anant Kaspi, the director of the Tasker Center for Accessible Technology at the University of Washington. And that access map she's been telling you about is up and running. It is at accessmapseattle.com. In fact, we are tweeting out a link to that right now. We're live tweeting at KUOW is our handle. And join us there at KUOW. You'll find that access map. And Kaspi also says her team is working on an app for iPhone and Android, and those ought to be ready to go by March. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Twelve 12:31 is the time. I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon to you. Google is in Seattle. Facebook is here. We have Apple. We have Pixar and eBay and Alibaba. These tech companies are not headquartered here, but they have engineering offices in the Seattle area. And the latest, well, I'll tell you about the latest in a moment. I'm not sure how I feel about it. Todd Bishop from tech news site GeekWire is here. Hey, Todd.
Hi, Bill.
The latest, it's California company.
That's right.
To open an engineering office here is Snapchat.
Which That's right.
All I know about Snapchat is you send a message and it disappears, and there's probably some worrisome reason why somebody wants it to disappear, and my daughter knows about it, and I'm not sure if I like it.
So fortunately, my daughter is too young to use Snapchat at this point, but I'm assured...
Oh, so is mine, but I'm still getting scared.
I'm assured by the younger people in our office that there are actual legitimate reasons to use Snapchat other than what you're imagining your daughter might be doing.
Basically, what is Snapchat, for those who don't know?
It is a messaging service that is very popular with millennials right now, and the whole idea, as you said, that the trademark hallmark feature is that the messages disappear after they're viewed for a certain amount of time. And this has really taken this demographic by storm. The millennials are very into Snapchat, and the it's really just taken off.
So what we want to talk about today is why are all these companies moving here. So Snapchat, why are they opening an office in Seattle?
So they're opening an office right there at First and Stewart, right across from the Pike Place Market. And this notably is the same place that Facebook got its start. The key is that there are engineers here. There is a pool of talent coming out of Microsoft, Amazon, the University of Washington. It's extremely competitive right now in Silicon Valley for these engineers. So there are big advantages to companies to create branch offices here in the Seattle area that they can use to then attract people from the local workforce.
But why? Why is a branch office worth all the effort? You know, there is technology that allows people to work remotely. I don't know if you're aware of that.
That's true. And certainly a lot of these companies do that. In fact, they're pioneering a lot of these technologies.
I've heard.
there's something to be said for still having a critical mass of engineers in one location. And this is certainly one of the key spots around the country and around the world that these engineering centers are being created. And it's the proximity to a lot of the talent as well. Coming out of the other companies, they can recruit them, poach them, and get them to work for their companies.
So one just basic example, an illustration to help me understand why a Silicon Valley company would find it so important to have 50 people here in downtown or Fremont or whatever.
Yep, absolutely. You know, SpaceX is a great example. They are building satellites in Redmond right now. That was one of the big stories of last year. This is the Elon Musk company that's competing with all sorts of other commercial space ventures. They put an office here in part because they want to be able to recruit video game developers, because it turns out that game developers are really good at creating space simulations that can be used to basically get these rockets off the ground. So just that kind of talent pool is something that they're trying to tap into.
And how does having all of these major tech players with a footprint here, how does that affect us?
In ways both positive and negative. There was a report that just came out recently from Zillow, the online real estate company, saying that home value growth in the Seattle area has risen about 5.4% over the past year. And that's well in advance of what's happening across the U.S. Home values across the U.S. are up only about 2.5%. So you're seeing really this influx of people start to put a lot of pressure on home values. Anybody buying or selling a house right now is seeing this. It's extremely competitive. You have cash buyers coming in and swooping things up. So that can be both positive or negative. If you own a house, it's great, and you're selling it, fantastic. If you're trying to buy one, it creates all sorts of competition, and it creates all sorts of affordability issues for people across the economic spectrum.
And within the industry, how does it affect us that we have all these big players here?
In the short term, it's very difficult for startups that are homegrown in Seattle, because suddenly they're not just competing with the Microsofts and the Amazons, the big giants that are based here. They're also competing for talent against all of these other companies coming in. So it can be much more difficult to launch a startup with top-notch engineers in Seattle. In the long run, it actually could be a good thing for the economy, because those engineers that are either brought here from Silicon Valley to work for these companies, or who come out of the local talent pool and work for a Facebook or a Google, in many cases, after 5 years, those people will spin off and launch their own startups. So it really fuels the economic engine in that way.
And how about outside the industry? You know, we think of Boeing as being its own ecosystem of jobs, right? It's not just making planes, but it's many, many suppliers, and the suppliers of those suppliers, and knock-on effects and all. But is that still true in our 2016 tech industries?
In a lot of ways, it is. You'll see service providers in particular, accountants, lawyers, recruiting firms benefit from that influx. And so there is a little bit more of a digital analog or a digital version of what you see with Boeing, where they're not people who are literally supplying widgets to these companies, but they're supplying services and people.
So lots of upsides, and then there's the trying to afford a place around here, or trying to get where you want to go, because there's sure a lot of employees.
Absolutely, and there was the report from Zillow called this the Silicon Refugee effect, where you've got people who are actually wanting to come to Seattle from the Bay Area just because it's so much more affordable here than it is there, even though it's less affordable here now than it was in the past.
And finally, if companies are more nimble than ever, you get the concern that a company like Snapchat could someday disappear as fast as a Snapchat message. They come and go.
That's right. That is one of the concerns. Will this tech economy continue to boom as it has? And if it doesn't, what happens to all of these big commitments that these companies have made in terms of leases or in the case of Amazon, new buildings?
we would keep on talking to you about it. That's what would happen. Todd Bishop from the tech news site GeekWire. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
KUOW Seattle. It's 12:38. We're glad you've tuned in. I'm Bill Radke. KUOW is The Record. Years ago, Mary Lou Balasone decided to become a foster parent. And then she adopted her two foster kids, Kayla and her brother Dustin. Today, her daughter Kayla is 26 years old. Mother and daughter talked about how they became a family at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood.
So, Mom, what made you decide you wanted to adopt kids?
I did want to have children in my life. I wasn't married. Didn't look like I was going to get married anytime soon. And I thought, I don't want to have birth children that I bring into this world when there's so many kids that need a family. And I also wanted to support what I thought was a better way for foster care.
Now, you adopted Dustin and I together. Did you think you would have more than one child before we both came along?
No. So I often would tease people and say, you know, really, you shouldn't be outnumbered by the number of kids you have. So if you're a single parent, two is probably a little more difficult. Well, luckily for me, you and Dustin were the first ones they called about. And of course I said, oh, yeah. Because the first time you came with me, I thought it was just going to be for the weekend. And I got the call on Thursday and I came and picked you up on Friday, you and Dustin up on Friday at the Department of Social and Health Services. Do you remember that?
I do remember. I remember feeling very shy and unsure why we were moving from home to home, but I also felt the need to impress you so that hopefully I would stay with you. Mm-hmm. I was 4.5 years old when this first happened.
And Dustin was 18 months. And I have a very clear memory of coming to pick you guys up because you were playing on this little slide thing. And you both were the cutest little things with your blonde hair and your cute little cheeks. And I have to say, at that very first moment, I thought, oh, these are my Balasone kids. In that time, how did you understand what was happening to you and Dustin?
I don't think I really understood what it meant until I was in about middle school. I think I just kept repeating what the adults around me were telling me. It took me, you know, many years to figure out really what foster care and adoption was, even after I was adopted. And when I came to realize that, it still took me years to process what was wrong with the life Dustin and I had before entering foster care. You know, I think I felt like it was normal or okay to be abusive towards children, and I don't think I totally understood, you know, why. Because, of course, she told me all the time, you know, that she loved me and everything like that. And I guess I didn't realize that actions and words are very different things at that young age, and that it takes a lot more than just loving somebody to be a parent to somebody. Those separate things, you know, because it's very separate. You know, loving somebody and being able to take care of them are very different. And I don't think I really knew what that meant until that. You remember that project I did where I had to take care of that baby in middle school in eighth grade? And I failed it the first time around because I didn't wake up when it would cry in the middle of the night. And so I had to do the project and keep that baby all over again. I think that was the first time I really realized that it took more than just wanting to be a parent and having a child to be a parent.
It's interesting that you felt like you weren't loved by her because I think she showed most of her attention to you. And I don't know if I've ever told you this, but about a year into you living with me, Annette approached her social worker and said that she was willing to let me adopt Dustin, but that she wanted you back.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I probably should have told you this before we started. Do you want me to change the subject?
No, it's okay.
But I said no. And I said no because Dustin was the person that had been in your life the longest.
And he's my best friend.
And he, yeah. And, you know, you used to kind of take care of him when he was a little boy. And you know, he had some hard times too because it wasn't a good situation for him.
I have no idea how grateful I am that you said no. Because we probably wouldn't have been together.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's, you know, sometimes people ask me would I do it again, and I'm like, I can't imagine my life without my children. Of course I would do it again. It's like when the judge asked me, do you understand what you're taking on? I'm like, well, yeah. This is my family. These are my kids.
That was Mary Lou Balasone and her daughter, Kayla Balasone, remembering, and in Kayla's case, learning about how they became a family. They talked to each other at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood. You can hear more local StoryCorps stories every Monday here on KUOW's The Record and at a live listening session at New Holly. That's going to be on February 4th. What's in your stash? You know, the chocolate stash you've got in your desk, your dresser drawer. You have a lot of choices for it, that's for sure. Even local choices for chocolates, because there are at least 20 chocolate makers just here in Western Washington. Which brings us to a question that listener Beth Ann Johnson of Tacoma asked KUOW's Local Wonder.
Why does Puget Sound have such a large chocolate industry?
To answer Beth Ann's question, we set out KUOW's intrepid reporter, Ruby DeLuna.
I know. Tough assignment reporting on chocolate, but someone's got to do it.
Okay, so you game?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Well, I did get help from Dr. Christy Leslie. She earned her PhD studying chocolate, and she teaches global studies at UW-Bothell. We're at the candy aisle at Bartell Drugs on University Way. We want to scope out the players. The first aisle has the familiar brands, Mars, Nestle, Cadbury, Hershey, and Ferrero. These are the big guys, the companies that dominate the chocolate market globally. Leslie says they're the chocolate of our youth.
Most of us would have grown up knowing these brands first, and this would have been our introduction to chocolate. Next aisle over is a more local selection.
Okay, let's head over there. Whoa.
Very pink and red. But of course, that's what we would expect because Valentine's Day is coming. And
the next aisle has the brands that are closer to home.
We have Ghirardelli, which of course are San Francisco based. And then if we move a little bit closer to Oregon, Moonstruck is represented here.
Then there's the home team. Seattle Chocolates, Dilettante, CEO. Where's France?
There maybe it's one aisle over.
There it is.
Oh, did you find France? Oh, there we go. Excellent.
France Chocolates is one of Seattle's early chocolate pioneers. Leslie says Fran Bigelow, the woman behind the confections, was a key innovator with her sea-salted caramels.
When I first tasted the sea-salted caramel, I was very trepidatious. I didn't know if salt and chocolate would be fine. And now, of course, that's what you see everywhere, 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 because it was such a tremendous complementary set of tastes.
Franz was part of the home team that gave us Kraft chocolate and introduced us to a bigger world beyond the candy of our youth. These pioneers also taught us a lot about quality chocolate. When Theo Chocolate came to the market, it did something that no other company had done before. It made chocolate from scratch, a bean-to-bar chocolate maker.
Which means they start with cocoa beans. That's what enters their factory, and finished bars leave it.
It's like a baker who buys grains to grind them into flour versus buying bags of flour. Franz, Dilettante, and Theo put Seattle on the map when it comes to chocolate. Leslie says they also established themselves right about the time of the local food movement, when consumers started becoming curious about their food. And it's still true today.
We like to know where our food comes from, and we like to see it on labels, on all of these labels I'm looking at right now on the Theo bars. I can see pictures of all the ingredients, and I think that in the Pacific Northwest, we really value that intimacy with our food.
That movement also fueled the support for local chocolate makers and their growth. Karen Neugebauer is heating up a bowl of melted chocolate in her commercial kitchen in Mount Vernon. The chocolate will soon coat a sheet of caramel squares waiting on the counter.
I don't use any thermometers whatsoever because it's a crutch. It basically gives you one out of the three things that you need. You need time, temperature, and motion.
Neugebauer started Forte Chocolates in 2006. Last year, two of her creations took home silver and bronze at the International Chocolate Awards.
Both the orange jazz and the cherry almond, which are very, very traditional old flavors, took world titles, so we're ecstatic.
Neugebauer is part of a growing number of artisan chocolate makers in the Puget Sound region. And what makes this community stand out is that the makers help and support each other.
There's a lot of sharing because we want to see everyone succeed. We respect what everyone else is trying to do.
Neugebauer says they talk to each other, whether it's for troubleshooting advice or to be a sounding board for ideas.
There's no competition when you love something. It's all about support and, you know, finding information and learning more. So I think that's really kind of what happened and why we're all kind of helping each other.
And it's not just sharing with colleagues, but with the public as well. In addition to creating chocolate confections, Neugebauer is helping grow the next generation of local chocolate makers. Another key ingredient for the region's strong chocolate culture is the consumers. The Northwest Chocolate Festival draws hundreds of people to the Seattle Bell Harbor Conference Center each year.
We just started, so we'll be here till the end.
Shirley Dujardin and her daughter, Cece Dickens, came to sample and learn more about chocolates.
And then you got to catch the lectures because they do the really good talks about describing the different regions of chocolate and stuff. So it's kind of like wine now. You get to be a connoisseur.
The festival is a place for consumers to meet the makers and give feedback. So why does the region have a large local chocolate industry? It has a community of artisan chocolate makers that continues to grow, a consumer base that knows its chocolates, and a public venue for aficionados to share and geek out about chocolate. And really, who doesn't like chocolate?
I'm odd for a Seattleite because I'm not really a coffee drinker, so I think I double up on the chocolates.
For Local Wonder, I'm Ruby DeLuna in Seattle.
That local wonder story was inspired by a question from a listener, Beth Ann Johnson, who has, she told us, her own chocolate stash, top left drawer, in her desk at work. Now, surely you have a question, a local wonder of your own. Ask it at our website, KUOW.org. Maybe we'll answer you. KUOW's The Record. It's 12:51. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle rap star Macklemore is out with a new track, and it is very conflicted.
If I'm only in this for my own self-interest, not the culture that gave me a voice to begin with, then this isn't authentic. It is just a gimmick. The DIY underdog, so independent. But the one thing the American dream fails to mention is I was many steps ahead to begin with.
The track is called White Privilege 2. He did a song 10 years ago called White Privilege. This one is a 9-minute affair in which Macklemore wonders about his own advantages, about his theft of African American music and styles, and he wonders about our silence. There's a lot there. What's he trying to accomplish? I spoke to Ahamefule Oluo, a Seattle musician and composer who was part of a group of Seattle artists who collaborated on that song.
I mean, it seems really, I think, at least to me, they wanted to make a message to young white people in America who have been able to kind of stay out of this issue. And to have someone, you know, who has kind of this window into those kids to say, I'm going to make this really controversial, kind of put myself out there. It seems like a plea to bring people up to a certain level of understanding.
Why is it controversial?
It's just controversial because it just doesn't happen. I mean, there really aren't white artists at that level of popularity with that kind of widespread appeal that are making statements like that. You know, I think that he's one of the few people that can do this, that doesn't have someone to tell him, no, this is a bad idea. And for me, it's really hard to see how this would be a self-serving move.
Well, what is he, to you, what is Macklemore advocating in the song? Like his famous song, Same Love, was very clear. Same-sex marriage, damn right I support it. This song, he's seems to be processing, right?
Yeah.
What was he advocating?
I think the biggest thing that this song does is say that as white people, I'm not a white person, but if I were a white person, the message would be, as white people, we have to start thinking about these things. And we have to actually start thinking about the role that we play in these. And we actually have to start having some introspection about these issues that affect American citizens. I think that there is something important about white people in America, particularly young white people in America, saying, I'm going to actually stop and think about these things. I'm going to think about why I react the way that I react to these things. I'm going to actually start thinking about the reality of the world. What am I doing? What am I not doing? And what role do I want to play? Yeah, it'd be great if white teenagers would listen to Angela Davis, or they would, you know, read Baldwin, and, you know, that'd be great. But they're not going to. And I think that this is a really great entrance to go through yourself, to start thinking about the role that you play, and then maybe at some point start applying changes to the way that, you go about your life.
The song asks, what are you willing to risk? What does Macklemore risk by making this track and video?
I mean, I think he's risking a lot of fans. There's just going to be some people that are not ready to hear this. And I think that he is risking losing more fans than he will gain through this action. That has to be something that he's aware of going into this thing. What you gain is not so much in quantity. It's not so much in just getting this message to as many people as possible. It's about sparking something in some people that creates an actual chain reaction in the way that they think and the way that they decide to perceive themselves in the world. And so I think the risk is losing fans, but I think the gain, you know, even if it's one person that gets that message and it starts a chain reaction and affects the way that they operate in the future, you know, I think it's worth it.
You submitted some music for this track, White Privilege. What's the song you would have written yourself?
The song I would have written would have been much different. You know, I can't write from the perspective of a young white person. It's just not the perspective that I've ever had. And I do write songs about those things. They are much different and maybe may come off as slightly angrier than this particular song.
You sound like you're choosing your words carefully.
It's hard to choose how to talk about these things. And it's really hard to do them right. And it's really, really hard for a white person to do them right because it's just fraught with danger. You know, there's no way of doing it perfectly. And, you know, I would have made a different song, but I also don't have millions of fans. And there's a reason for that.
There's a section of the song where Macklemore is representing somebody who loves thrift shop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it sounds like a white mom who, you know, you're the rapper that I let my kids listen to and you're so positive. But then she ends up looking clueless in this topic when it comes to race.
Yeah.
How much does he risk telling his fans he thinks they're clueless?
I mean, we live in a white supremacist society. We are clueless. Everyone is clueless. And I think that he portrays himself as, to a certain extent, clueless in this issue. So, you know, I think at a certain point, When you go to YouTube and you look at the video for Thrift Shop and you see that it's been viewed literally hundreds of millions of times, which is, you know, as many people as there are in this country, you know, I think at a certain point you get to honestly assess your cachet in society and say that, okay, I have said things that people have heard and people have responded to. Now I have a responsibility. What am I going to do with that?
Why didn't he figure out how to make his white privilege angst and conflict really grabby and 4-minute anthem?
I mean, this is not going to be a digestible message. To actually do justice to the message that needs to be said, a certain level of discomfort is necessary. I think that in general, as we address these issues, a certain level of discomfort is necessary in addressing these issues in ways that, you know, are not about just making them easy to swallow.
It's not an easy 9 minutes.
No, it's not. It's not even for me. I'm like, oh man, go easy on yourself a little bit, but I get over it.
Go easy. You're thinking even for you. Yeah, you're thinking Macklemore. Are you okay?
Yeah. I mean, that's just the general human empathy that I have is like, man, you're going to be all right. It's a just hang in there. You're doing the right thing.
In that way, he does seem to represent a lot of white people with this. I'm nervous. Should I be here? What should I say? Was it okay that I said that?
Yeah, and those are valid emotions, and those are valid feelings, and those are kind of valid conflicts that we're going to have to address as we try to actually move forward, you know, in solving these issues that go back to the foundation of our country. And this is the way that I look at it. If he is making the right choice, this is what he's doing. This is the right thing to do. Whether or not that makes it good, you know, for me, it's hard to fault people doing the right thing.
Your silence is a luxury. Hip hop is not a luxury.
We were listening there to Seattle musician and composer Ahame Fule Oluo. He was part of a group of Seattle artists who collaborated on Macklemore's new track. It's called White Privilege 2, and you're hearing a little piece of it now. You can hear the whole thing and decide for yourself. Just join us on Twitter. We're tweeting a link right now to the video of the song White Privilege 2. Go to @KUOW.